And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Metrospective. I'm Ted Berg, joined on the line, as always, by the Athletics Mets beat writer Tim Britton. Tim, they are getting dinner.
Getting a nice classic Italian meal, Ted.
The story we've been waiting for.
Ravioli and chicken parm.
Really, the whole spring we've been talking about when's it going to happen. Francisco Lindor and the Mets, they've both sounded so open to extension, almost strangely candid about how eager they are to work this out. And then remind me if there's any precedent for something like this coming out while the negotiations are sort of going on like that. And I say this after having shared that story about Johan Santana and them ordering dinner during those negotiations. But that was me sneaking around. This is Steve Cohen is just out there telling people that he is negotiating with Francisco Lindor, going so far as to say that wherever they ate, the ravioli was bad. And Francisco Lindor got chicken parm. We don't know how Lindor felt about the chicken parm.
I think he clarified that the sauce was the issue. You go back 2 years. I remember like the Jacob DeGrom extension. The tip-off was that DeGrom and Brody Van Wagenen were both not in Sarasota like the last day of spring training. And that was how you should have been able to figure out that something was coming close. I don't think this means that it's a set or a done deal, but it does show that, deadlines matter to an extent, and they kind of expedite the process when you're late in spring training. It's nice that some people are still in a position where they can hash things out over a good meal, because it's been a really long time since I've been able to do that with anyone.
I feel like, we know it wasn't a good meal, and that sort of rubs me the wrong way a little bit, because it feels like it's going to come out where they ate, and then that restaurant is going to have to deal with like the fact that Steve Cohen said their ravioli wasn't very good or there's a sauce issue. I appreciate the candor, but it's like are you not worth $10 billion? Like, could you not like fly in Wolfgang Puck to make this meal?
I mean, Guy Fieri is his guy in that regard.
Guy Fieri is his guy. I don't know this connection.
Oh yeah, so Steve Cohen and Guy Fieri are friends. I think Steve Cohen has long enjoyed Guy Fieri's work and his television programming, and has like spent a day with him just eating at different restaurants. And Guy Fieri has did an episode of what is the show? Dives. Drive-ins.
Diners, drive-ins, and dives. Yeah.
Diners, drive-ins, and dives. Yeah.
Triple D, baby. Yeah.
I always get the wrong order of them. He did an episode at Super Duper Weenie, which is a hot dog stand and truck that Steve Cohen is very fond of in Stamford, Connecticut, and that is very well known for its premier hot dogs. And the episode really did make me want a hot dog in a way that I haven't in a long time.
Connecticut has a whole big hot dog scene. Like Connecticut and Westchester too, that there's a big hot dog thing going on there. Some places fry hot dogs. A lot of places like split and grill hot dogs. There's a lot of pride in the hot dog prep in that region.
I think Connecticut tries to push this very strong food narrative. You've got New Haven Pizza. You got all the food trucks outside New Haven on 95 that I always think about stopping at for lunch when I drive by. But I'm surprised that Steve did not have Super Duper Weenie come down to cater with Lindor. Or at least, they didn't get pizza, which is Lindor's proclaimed favorite food. So, I think this might have been a compromise for both of them.
One time I saw Tim Tuffle in a famous hot dog place in Westchester. I've written about this story, so it's not worth resharing, but it was a strange like fan experience for me because I had interviewed Tim Tuffle like twice that year. It was when he was in Binghamton too. So I was, you know, I can't imagine many reporters had come out and dealt with him. So it was like, maybe Tim Tuffle recognizes me here. And it's a tiny place, and it's going to be super awkward if we acknowledge that we know each other. So instead of eating in the tiny little hot dog place, I left because I was uncomfortable about professional awkwardness with Tim Tuffle. does this mean it's getting done? Is the deal getting done? Am I going to watch them like hand him his jersey back at a press conference tomorrow to say that it's 10 years and it's $320 million. And now the Mets have their shortstop for the next decade.
You know, I think the whole time I've remained relatively optimistic that something is going to get done. There's really been no reason to be pessimistic about it. Both, you know, like you mentioned, Lindor has talked rather openly about his willingness to sign an extension. Cohen and the Mets have talked about their willingness to sign him to an extension. It makes sense for both sides at a certain level and at a certain rate that they can. There's probably some overlapping ground where it makes sense for both of them. And there's really been nothing. You know, you go back to the DeGrom one 2 years ago, and it was funny in retrospect. But DeGrom, I think it was a Saturday start in spring training, like his last start in spring training. We asked him in the scrum afterward, like, how are you feeling about an extension? And he said, you know, at this point, like, I'm feeling less optimistic about it. I don't know that it's going to happen. And that was basically because him and Jeff Wilpon and the Mets had been on, like, had miscommunicated over the timing of a meeting that was supposed to happen one day, and it happened a day later because of a miscommunication. Classic Mets. But then, you know, 2 days later, they basically came to terms. So it was, you know, everything in the Sunday papers was, this isn't going, this might not happen. This is a bad sign for them. And then by Tuesday or Wednesday, they're celebrating the extension. So there's really been nothing that points to this not happening. I know that's a weird way of putting it, but I do think in general, like it still might not happen by first pitch Thursday night. Maybe the announcement comes sometime after that. But I do think I would remain surprised if Francisco Lindor and the Mets do not come to terms on an extension in the next couple of weeks.
How long is it going to be?
I mean,
not until they announce the extension. How long is Lindor getting locked up?
Oh, I was. Yeah, there is a difference.
No, you just answered that question. Yeah, no.
Longer than 2 weeks.
right.
I mean, I think it's probably 10 or 11 is my guess. Years.
Like the Machado, with the Machado deal is sort of a framework here.
Yeah. You know, you look, we've talked about this going back to January that, you know, the Mets, it would behoove the Mets in a way that teams got away from the double digit year contracts for a while. And now they're back interested in them to an extent because they reduce the average annual value towards your luxury tax payroll. And that's what the Mets are most concerned about, is their luxury tax payroll, not the actual money in the deal as much. So in the same way, the Phillies basically agreed they were going to give Bryce Harper $330 million before they decided how many years they were going to give it to him over. Then they figured out that 13 was what fit. I think we'll see a similar thing with Lindor. They probably work on a number first, and then they work backward toward the years that make sense for both sides. I think it probably ends up 10 or 11.
And I think that that's an important thing to think about in the back end of some of these contracts that people forget about all the time, is you're paying for, right, the Mets might pay Lindor over the course of the next 11 years. They're paying him that money, whatever that number is, for like the next 5 or 6 years, right? And if you went by like those traditional, you know, dollar per war estimates, which are finicky, I think you could make a good case that it's like, oh, he's definitely going to be worth his whole contract. If he plays as well as we know he can play, he's going to be worth his whole contract in like 6 or 7 years, 5, 6, 7 years. And then those extra years, like, they have him. And if he's good, that's gravy. You know, that's like he provided the value on this contract, and everything else from here on out is the gravy stuff. I think that's a better way of looking at it as than saying, like, when it gets to be a 36-year-old Francisco Lindor playing shortstop and getting paid $30 million and saying, oh, like, he's an albatross.
Yeah, I mean, one of the major pros in acquiring Lindor was you were getting him for a large chunk of his prime. You know, he's going to play this year at age 27. Everyone else you were looking at in free agency, be it George Springer, Trevor Bauer, JT Realmuto, they were going to be at least 30 this season. A guy like Springer is going to be 31. So you get 4 years of Lindor before he's the age Springer would have been had you signed him this past offseason. So I think that's a big advantage. And Lindor is a guy who I think you look at some of the longer-term projections of him. I know Dan Zimborski at FanGraphs did this a while back. So I was looking at it when I wrote about what an extension might look like. Basically, you know, playing it out, like Francisco Lindor can still be a major league average player like 8 years from now when he's 35 or something like that, and can still be providing some value for you at that age. There's always the chance these guys fall off a cliff that is probably more prevalent in pitchers than in anything else. Second basemen generally have a tough aging curve. And a lot of guys don't play shortstop long-term, but Lindor at least has the agility and the defensive skills now that you can project him out a bit more comfortably than you could with some other guys. And some other guys who are going to be free agents this upcoming offseason, by the way. So I think that's what you like about a long-term arrangement here is, yeah, you're paying mostly for the front part of it, the front half of it, but there's still, he's young enough when you're signing this. This isn't signing Robinson Cano, who's already in his 30s, to a 10-year deal. This isn't signing Miguel Cabrera at 33 to an 8-year deal. This is signing a guy who's going to be, you know, the first year of this deal is going to be he's 28 years old. You sign him for 11 years, you're still not getting him at age 40 at any point.
And I think it's a statement for the Cohen administration, right? Like you got the big fish this offseason, and then you make him the face of your franchise. Like that is I think for an owner, and I'm starting to have, you know, like I hate that I am, but I'm starting to have like some reservations about the Twitter stuff, just like because of the hubris of sort of advertising that you're negotiating this thing, just in case that goes awry. But I guess it's on him, not me, right? But I think as an owner, there's nothing you could do to like better introduce yourself to a fan base than being like, hey, yeah, we went out and we traded for the best player who changed hands. Oh, Nolan Arenado is obviously a superstar as well, but one of the very best players who changed hands this offseason. And then we locked him up for you know, the next decade. He's going to be he's our guy here. Like, this is how we're doing things. Yeah, makes you kind of like Steve Cohen if you're a Mets fan.
Yeah, I think it would, you know, answer the, I think, misguided criticism that they didn't do, they didn't spend enough in the offseason, that they didn't sign Realmuto, Springer, or Bauer. If you bring in Lindor, you bring him in with the idea of signing him to a monster extension. You know, Sandy Alderson said the right things. We made the trade with 2021 in mind. We'll see what happens in the future. But certainly you make that trade with the idea that you are going to extend him. So extending him is really just like the fulfillment of that process that they started with the deal the first week of January. And I think should make Mets fans feel really good about the direction of this franchise under Cohen versus what it had been previously.
Yeah, and I think you can, you know, easily make the case that, you know, the money people said they should have spent going out and getting, you know, two of those top, or any two of the top, whether it was, you know, Realmuto and Springer, or Springer and Bauer, or any two of the top three or four free agents, I think it's very reasonable to say it's better spent on Lindor and extensions. And you know, I don't want to beat down the extension conversation again, but there are just so many guys on this team that, even after Lindor, that seem like they're worthy of extending. And Conforto will obviously be the next one in the spotlight because he's the closest to free agency. But I'm hoping still that this is the first domino and that there will be a bunch of extensions after this.
If you were taken out to an Italian restaurant by Steve Cohen, what would be your go-to order?
It might be chicken parm. It depends on, you know, it's like a touch and feel thing for me with Italian restaurants because my mom is Italian. Like, Italian food is the one closest to my soul, I think. So I would tend to like feel a place up and say like, okay, is this a place that's going to make me a really great chicken parm, which is like a very specific type of Italian restaurant? Or like, is this like a Northern Italian place where I want like a veal under some sort of melted cheese with some sort of pork added in there. I'm thinking of a very specific meal from a very specific restaurant, but you know, it's not easy. It's not easy to find like a nice restaurant in Port St. Lucie. I don't know if you've tried, but that's not like that's a challenge in itself. And again, this guy's got a helicopter, right? He has to have a helicopter. Why don't you put Francisco Lindor in your helicopter and take him to Miami? Because to me, like that's how you woo the player. If I had a helicopter, is that a reasonable trip? Is that not a helicopterable? Because people helicopter the Hamptons from New York City, right? So that's got to be like the same distance, Port St. Lucie to Miami.
You know, I haven't looked it up on the Google Maps. I don't know click how the long
you
take. Icon.
I don't know where you go, like where the cutoff is from helicopter to private jet. I'd like to find out. Like, I would like that to be an issue for me at some point in life, but I would have to ask Steve Cohen.
Right. It's been funny thinking about this. There is like the Italian restaurant in Port St. Lucie that I go to once or twice a spring, and it's fine. You know, like they make a decent chicken parm. That's usually what I get when I'm there. And the idea of Cohen and Lindor sitting down there is pretty funny to me. I don't know where the nicer Italian restaurant in that area is. I've been trying, you know, it's not Chili's, it's not Applebee's, it's not Texas Roadhouse and all the stuff.
Ruby Lone Tuesdays, Star Steakhouse it's and not, like there. There's every single one. It's like the nexus of casual dining establishments. I was wondering, you know, I thought it would be funny if they went in Kareem Garcia's honor to the pizzeria once micturated upon by several Mets outfielders, or that Carrabba's by the Marriott where everybody stays, which is a chain place and not that bad. I'll say not that bad. It's funny to just think of like, yeah, to think of a billionaire and Francisco Lindor, this like very recognizable, sort of very flamboyantly hair-colored baseball player just sort of strutting into a chain restaurant in Port St. Lucie and sitting down for a meal to hammer out a $300 million contract.
I want to hear a Carrabba's ad with your voice at the end going, yeah, it's not that bad for a chain.
It's not that bad. It's not. Have you had Carrabba's? It's not that bad.
I haven't had it at the Port St. Lucie one. I think the last time I went to a Carrabba's was in college.
Okay. I actually never knew it existed until it appeared in that parking lot in Port St. Lucie. Because Port St. Lucie and really most of, I would say like everything in Florida south of Orlando is actually just one, it's all connected by parking lots. Like you could navigate the entire southern half of Florida without leaving a parking lot if you wanted. And the Carrabba's is in the parking lot. And it's okay. They give you a whole sack of like sides with whatever you order. So if you get chicken parm, you have like one bag that's your chicken parm, and then there's like another huge bag that's like bread and salad and a vegetable and breadsticks and like all sorts of, and like a Caesar salad, you know, just tons and tons of things that are like the sides. They're definitely giving you as many calories worth of side as entree. Which I appreciate because
you've got to compete with the Olive Garden and the endless breadsticks and endless salad and endless mediocrity and all that.
And the sadness, the overwhelming sadness.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Let's talk about what's going to happen this season, other than the sadness. We did some over-unders for pitching, and we did some over-unders for offense. What we didn't do, which is a pretty big one, is a win-loss over-under, right? How many wins? What would be your over-under for the Mets' win total in 2021? And let the audience know I am putting you on the spot. We did not prepare this.
Right, yeah. I mean, I gave you at least 30 seconds of notice with all of the over-unders in the previous episodes. I would send you like 16 of them right before we went to, right before we started recording. I think, you know, in terms of wins, I think you're probably... I don't know what the Vegas consensus over-under is. I would guess it's right around 92-ish.
I mean, Vegas is amazing at it, you know, but I think that... I don't think that Vegas is the best way to... Yeah, I mean, for gambling, obviously, it's the only way, right? But I feel like those odds aren't necessarily tied to what's mostly likely to happen so much as it's tied to, like, some of the habits of betting, too, right? So, like, the Met total and the Yankee total and the Red Sox total tend to go up a little bit over the projections, I think. Right? Am I wrong about it? Like, I feel like because they adjust to how people bet. And obviously, there are just like in the places with big fan bases, there are just a lot more people putting down money on, you know, those teams than are betting on like the Brewers.
Yeah, you know, you never trust a line on like Notre Dame football or something like that.
Right. Right.
So, I mean, I would think the over under for the wins would be in that 90-ish, 90 to 92 area. I think it starts with a 9. You know, I think
that's good.
I might take the under depending on where we put it within that area.
91.5. I'm saying 91.5.
Well, that makes it harder. If you had said 92.5, I would have felt very good about taking the under. You said 90.5. I think 91. Let's say 91 wins is how I'm feeling at the moment, which is different for me because usually, regardless of what team I'm covering, I feel really strongly that it is an 84 win team. At the start of the season, like my first year on the beat, I covered the 2011 Red Sox, and I thought they were going to win 100 games, and they were looking good for a while outside of the start of the season, and then they collapsed in September, and then the year after that, I was like, you know what, they're okay. They might win like 84, and I kept thinking that about teams that won the World Series and finished in last place in rapid succession, and the Mets, I feel like under the Wilpons, were like perennially constructed to max out at about 84 wins if things broke right.
So the Vegas actually is lower. It's from BetMGM, it's 90.5 is the over under for the Mets.
So I might go over that and under 92.5, which I think means I'm pretty much right at the 91-92 mark. I don't know if that's good enough to win the division though. I think it's possible. You know, we've seen wild cards with some pretty unimpressive records over the last several years, but I do think in the National League we could see a pair of 90 plus win wild card teams between the East and the West,
but not the Central.
No, I don't think we'll see any teams win 90 games in the Central.
I don't know. It's weird doing this as a civilian, I guess, because it's like I'm trying to weigh my own biases and everything. Like, the Braves are a really good team. The Braves are a really good offensive team. Like, do the Braves have the, you know, I'm just like, do the Braves have the pitching depth? I know they have tons of young pitchers, like guys who are really like knocking on the door, but it's hard to know because how many times have we seen a team with a ton of young pitchers and then it just doesn't really work out? I'll take the over on 91.5. I think it'll be, and that's always a bad bet with baseball, right? Like, you always want to bet on just like the mean. I don't know. I like them. I like the Mets. I think they're good, and I think they're going to win like 93 or 94 games, and that's going to be enough to win the division.
It has been, what is 06 the last time they won more than 90? Because 15 they won 90 even. And then 07 and 08, they fell just shy of 90, if I remember correctly. I think they were around 89 and 88 those years. So I think it'd be 06 was the last time they won a 91st game in a regular season.
So this is, it's coming back. It's because Steve Cohen, he's bringing it back. He's bringing back win number 91.
It would be odd if, and Mets fans, I think, would enjoy it very much, if this did play out, at least in the regular season, like 2006, where you got excited about the season, and then like 2 weeks into the year, the Mets clinched the National League East, if I remember.
Right, it was just like, oh, right, like, do I have to should I bother watching? Or like, you know, they're just going to run away? Because, yeah, that, that, they, they clinched in like mid-August or late August, right? Like it was just, there was no, and whenever it was over for a month before that too.
Yeah, I just remember them starting very hot and leading the East by a solid 5 or 6 games very quickly. And, you know, the June conversation, they were up 7 games in the division by April 29th of that season. And they were 16-7. No one else was good at that point in the division. And I remember thinking, like, by June, like, it's basically just setting up the postseason rotation, figuring out who's going to start behind Glavin and Pedro.
I don't think it'll be that easy. I think that, I don't know, now I'm thinking about the Phillies, and I'm thinking, because I kind of feel like the Phillies are better than the projections say a little bit, just a little bit. And you know, the Braves are pretty good, and the Nationals are pretty good. It's a good, it's like, I don't know. I still think the Mets will win it. I think they have the best team. Is that, Fangraphs thinks it too, so I'm not alone. I just feel like their offense is so deep. And I don't know. It's so hard to figure out if I'm deluding myself or not. But when I look at the team and I look at the lineup, it's like there's not a bad hitter. There's not a bad hitter in this lineup. That is a nightmare for an opposing pitcher. Like there are a bunch of really good hitters and a bunch of pretty good hitters. And that's it. There's no scrub in the whole lineup. And that, I don't know. I just feel like that's like offense breeds offense. And the pitching, they've got DeGrom going once every 5 days. So once every 5 days, you are like top, obvious best pitcher in baseball. And I think the rest of it is good enough and maybe deep enough to just be a really good team. You know, I have questions about the bullpen. I have questions about the back end of the starting rotation. But what team doesn't have questions about the bullpen and the back end of the starting rotation? And what team can match the Mets like 1 through 8 in the lineup?
Yeah, like it's, I run into this problem every spring where I think I do feel pessimistic about the team I'm covering because I'm aware of its flaws very intimately because I see them on a regular basis. And I feel like you get kind of inured to a team's strengths. You know, you see this lineup on a regular basis. You're like, yeah, it's a pretty good lineup. They got 8 guys who are good. But, you know, their 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th guys in the bullpen don't look that hot. And that's, I think that's the pessimistic way of looking at a team. And, you know, if I were in Braves camp and, you know, from afar, I look at the Braves, I'm like, that's a strong top half of the lineup. Top part of the rotation looks good. I would probably be having the same questions about the back half of their lineup. You know, you're trusting Austin Riley to do a lot. You know, you don't really know who the 8th inning guy in that bullpen is, let alone the 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th guys, because they've got a lot of people in their bullpen currently. So you can construct those questions about all the teams in the East. You know, I think you've got a lot of really good 1 through 3s in rotations, at least at the start of the season. And it'll be interesting to see, like, you know, how does Mike Soroka look when he comes back for Atlanta? That's a big step compared to how does Syndergaard and or how do Syndergaard and Carrasco look for the Mets when they come back? You know, who gets the most out of those 4th and 5th spots in the rotation? You know, what does Washington get out of a John Lester after their Scherzer, Strasburg, Corbin trio?
I forgot they signed John Lester. He's good. Yeah, I mean he's been a horse. You know, okay, go on.
Yeah, so I think a lot of it is trying to figure out like who of those other people are going to step up who aren't the star players. The, you know, the Mets have a lot of those guys in their lineup who, you know, if James McCann has the type of year that he's had the last 2 years, well, that's a guy who's not going to stay hitting 8th for you probably, regardless of the rest of the shape of your lineup. And that can be a big change to how good that lineup is. And you know, injuries, of course, always come into play. I thought it was interesting. Eno Saris at The Athletic wrote a story on Monday, about his bold predictions for the year. And he thought the Mets were deep enough to win a World Series, that they had the depth that they would need in the case of injury, which they haven't had in a really long time. You know, you go back to probably 16 is the last time you probably didn't feel it going into 16, but eventually in 16, you realize they had enough depth to be a playoff team, but probably not to be beyond that. This year, you know, maybe they have the depth to absorb Jeff McNeil missing some time or Dom Smith missing some time or, you know, Stroman missing some time in a way that they weren't able to absorb those types of things in years past.
Bite your tongue. Dom Smith will not miss time.
75 home runs in 110 games. That's what he's going to do.
Speaking of which, who will be the Mets MVP in 2021?
I think you stick with DeGrom, don't you?
Yeah, I guess it just depends on how if you're I feel like with a team MVP, nobody has any qualms about saying the pitcher is the MVP, right? Who will be the Mets' second most valuable player in 2021, Tim?
I think the most valuable position player. I think that is an interesting question. You know, we talked last week about how I thought Jeff McNeil could be a dark horse MVP candidate. He has not had a great spring. So I think I'm going to go. I think this is one of those years where you might really enjoy seeing the all-around ability of Francisco Lindor. Like I feel pretty confident Lindor is going to lead the Mets in wins above replacement. Whether that makes him kind of the consensus position player MVP. I believe he'll lead position players in WAR. I don't know that he'll beat DeGrom, but whether that translates to the fan base believing he's the most valuable player, I'm not sure about that. But I think he'll probably, I think in my mind at season's end, if I have a National League MVP vote, Lindor would be the first Mets position player on my list.
I'm looking up Bonds WAR total in 2001. He was at 11.9. So that's going to get Dominic Smith past DeGrom, right? Like that's going to be better than that. So I feel like it'll be Smith if he doesn't do the 75 home run thing. Like, and I think I said this before, I kind of feel like Conforto is ready for like that. Okay, I'm like, because Conforto has had like some really high quality offensive seasons, but I don't think he's had like that national moment where people say like, okay, this guy's a star. And I kind of want that to be this year. So I think that I think Lindor is like the chalk pick for team MVP. I think Dom Smith, assuming he hits 75 home runs, is a lock for it. But if that doesn't happen, I think that Conforto, despite, you know, his that he's a corner outfielder, I just feel like, again, that's a type of guy who hits well with runners on base, who is a, he's such like a, I don't know, he's such a fun hitter to watch and such like a, he always has felt like just like a very polished and smart and disciplined hitter. And I feel like those type of guys succeed when they're in a really good lineup, even though I think, you know, we both know lineup protection has largely been discounted statistically, or at least there's very little evidence of it. Except that offense does breed offense. That is true. And it's one of those things that where like I always have my suspicions just because baseball players will insist throughout, like no matter what, they will always say it's, you know, that does change pitcher's approach. I think Conforto benefits from it and has a huge year. That would be my sleeper pick for MVP. Who will be their second best pitcher?
I mean, I think that's probably Stroman, just because Carrasco and Syndergaard, who might, you know, if they had a full season, be better than Stroman. I think, you know, I don't have like a feel for Stroman having a great year, like much better than people expect or much worse than people expect. I think like he will be about what you expect, which I think is a really good and really valuable pitcher. You know, he doesn't have to be an ace to be really good and really valuable. He's still a guy that I think you'd feel pretty comfortable with starting a playoff game for you and starting potentially game two of a playoff series behind Jacob DeGrom. He's pitched some big games in his career, Stroman has. So I think that's someone that I think just because of the way the injuries have hit the rest of the rotation, that I feel pretty confident in saying he'll be better than Walker or Peterson or Lucchesi. Or I guess you could have gone with Diaz out of the bullpen, but
yeah,
I
was going to go with Diaz out of the bullpen because of how good he looked. Despite, you know, he was wild a little bit and he had some blown saves, like sort of a disproportionate amount for how good he was, I think, last year. But it just, to me, he was so much more the pitcher last year that he was in 2018. We talked about the music thing and whatever it was. Like, I feel like that guy, that electric lights out, you know, every night closer type thing, is a really valuable guy to have. We've seen it, right? Like, it's just a nice thing to be able to know that the game is over when you go in with the lead in the ninth inning. And I feel like what we saw in 2020 is, I hope, what we'll see in 2021, because it's fun. So I think that's my candidate for second best.
A good shutdown closer is a beat writer's best friend, because it means no late game rewrites.
I had to do the like the instant recap, which was a USA Today thing. Like someone had to file right at the deadline, and I was on that duty for the game 7 in 2015, the Cubs Indians game with the like Rajai Davis home run in the top of the ninth and bottom of the eighth. God, that was a nightmare. Just a nightmare. it was like, people were texting me like, this is the single greatest baseball game ever played. And I was like, this is the worst thing that has ever happened. Like, this is a horrible game. Why couldn't it be like 6-1?
I remember going from covering the 2012 Red Sox, who had like a revolving door at closer. They blew several saves, especially in very dramatic fashion, especially early in the season, to 2013 when they had an unsettled closer experience the first 2.5 months, and then they
went
to Koji Uehara.
And he was unbelievable that year.
He was not just lights out, but he was lights out like with extreme efficiency. It was like a lot of 1-2-3 ninth innings in 7 or 8 pitches that I actually had to, as a beat writer, change how early I started my running game story to account for the ninth inning being much shorter than it used to be. Like, you know, when you don't have a good closer, you're like, you know, you might start at the seventh inning stretch or something because you're not as sure that whatever you're writing is going to last. Whereas when Uehara is closing, you got to start by like the middle of the sixth inning because the ninth inning is going to be very quick.
I never wrote gamers for SNY, but I did cover the 2008 Mets. And if you ever want to know what it's like to not feel confident in a lead. You know, and people, I'm sure many of us out there, many people out there remember the 2008 Mets. It was like a joke. It was every single night the bullpen blew it. So I also had like, who will be their most valuable reliever? I just gave my answer. Do you think it's Diaz as well?
Yeah, I think it's Diaz. I mean, I think if you want to make a case like, if you consider Diaz more of a given, like who is the X factor reliever, mm-hmm. I think it could be someone like Miguel Castro, who's looked great in spring training. And it becomes like, you know, it's interesting the way, I think the way we've talked about Miguel Castro, or the way the Mets fan base has talked about him on the Twitter sphere.
I don't believe we've talked about Miguel Castro at all. Go on.
You know, the start of spring training, it's like, oh, like that's the guy you always forget when you're listing out who's in the bullpen. To now, it's like, I feel great about Miguel Castro in the seventh inning because he's had a really nice spring. If he is that pitcher that he's been this spring, that is really, really nice to have. It allows, you know, it frees you up when Seth Lugo comes back to use Lugo more creatively than as just a regular setup man. It allows Trevor May to kind of settle into a role himself and just gives you more structure in the back end of the game. If Castro is instead kind of what he was or what he has been in his career, which is a guy with really good stuff, walks too many guys, just the ERA isn't quite where you want it to be. It's mm-hmm. fine, but it's just not dominant. If he's that guy, well, then the bullpen looks a lot shakier. So I think right now, if I'm looking at like who's going to define how this bullpen feels the first part of the year, I think it is Castro. Although, of course, if Diaz has the struggles that he's had in the past, that changes everything as well.
Miguel Castro's, maybe you have more information on this. Miguel Castro's baseball reference page states that his nicknames are, one is Ni, N-I. Is that a nickname for Miguel Castro? Ni? And then the other one is a little bit of a mystery because I don't know if they don't have diacritics in this section. I don't know if it's Come Hombre. Or come hombre, that's like funny, like come hombre, like a pun on come home. Or is it come hombre, which would be like he eats man, which
man
is
eater?
A man eater. Yeah, like man. That wouldn't be how you said that, right? But that's what it says. It says C-O-M-E, no accent, hombre, or ni. Those are his nicknames. I don't know. I have never noticed this before, and I've definitely been to this baseball reference page.
I kind of zone out on the nicknames. You know, I know you like Taco Bell. I don't think you've ever called Jacoby Ellsbury Tacoby Bellsbury.
I 100% have in print on multiple occasions. Just go on.
Because that was his. Did he get that nickname just because he was like the first guy
the
to
first
steal a base?
The first steal a taco guy.
Steal a taco. Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like a Taco Bell exec and also, was just like, now we get to change it.
Also because his name is like freakishly similar to Taco Bell, right? Like there's a lot to it.
I've always thought it's a stretch.
It's
too much
multi-layered. It's multi-layered. So we're going to need you as our man on the inside to figure out what the story is with that. there's no answer for this. Who's going to be the Mets rookie of the year in 2021?
Who? Yeah, that
like,
is.
Are the Mets going to play a rookie in 2021?
I'm trying to think of who would qualify as a rookie, like out of the bullpen.
Because Peterson's no longer a rookie, right? Like he doesn't count.
I'm not sure how they changed the rules because he might still count because I believe it was 50 innings is supposed to be the rule.
Oh, he's just under, right?
Just under that. So he might still qualify as a rookie this year. Like there are, there's...
Doesn't feel like a rookie. He was on the team the whole year last year.
He got a full year of service time. I don't know who... I forget who won Rookie of the Year last year in both leagues, as I often forget. I know like Cabrian Hayes had a chance to win last year and win again this year. I'm not sure how it is with Peterson. I feel like he doesn't count because of the full year of service time and Baseball Reference does say he exceeded rookie limits in 2020. Okay. If it's not him, the only guy I can think of them calling up and really having an impact would be like Khalil Lee from the position player standpoint. From a pitcher standpoint, I can't think of who in the bullpen would qualify that they would call up relatively early in the season to be impactful. Because guys like Stephen Tarpley and Riley Gillum, I mean, maybe Sam McWilliams would be that guy.
That's a good call. That's a good call because he's pitched. Oh no, he's never pitched in the majors.
Right. So he would be a rookie. Yeah. So maybe that's the guy who's got the best chance.
I think that's a good call.
Actually. Well, Tarpley's
not a rookie, right? Tarpley's pitched.
Yeah, he's been in the majors for a few different occasions. I'm not sure exactly if he's exceeded the rookie limits yet.
I'm trying to think of others. I think McWilliams is a good call. Hey, Wilfredo Tovar, still a rookie, technically.
Terrific spring training. Really looked good.
It's just nice. It's comforting to have Wilfredo Tovar back playing in spring training games, being a pretty good defensive player. Do you have any other season prediction type stuff? That was all I wrote down.
How do you have the NL East finishing? Because we elided that earlier.
Yeah, I guess I would say Mets, Braves, Phillies, Nationals, Marlins. That would be how I play it. That's is that chalk? That might be chalk.
Yeah, I think most people view it in three tiers. It's kind of the Mets and Braves at the top, and you can order that how you want. Nats and Phillies in the middle, you can order that how you want, and Marlins fifth. I do think like Miami is a decent fifth place team. Like we've gotten better than what we're
accustomed to for sure.
Yeah, like you get used to them being like, oh, they're going to win 65 or 66 games. I think this year that's a team that I could easily see going like 76 and 86, which doesn't sound great, but is a really annoying thing to have when that is the worst team in your division.
And that's a good team in a division that's as deep as this one. That's a pretty good team. That's a team that in the NL Central might be running away with things.
Yeah, so I think like, I'll probably okay. Yeah. I'd probably go Braves, Mets, Nats, Phillies, Marlins. Although your point about the Phillies does make me think that maybe they've got a shot to. I think things can go south on the Nationals, more so than they can go really south on another of those top four teams. Like if a team that isn't the Marlins is going to finish fifth, I think it's Washington because the lineup could just not work right. You know, they're so reliant on the star power there. Like if Juan Soto or Trey Turner misses a significant amount of time, that team's in a lot of trouble. If Schwarber or Bell are not what you need them to be in the middle of the order, the rest of that lineup doesn't look great. So I think things can go south on them. That's a team that can lose 90 games more easily than I think Atlanta, New York, or even Philly could lose 90. But I'll still keep them ahead of the Phillies now, but I might change that by Thursday.
So Mets fans, Tim Britton doesn't like your team. He doesn't think they're going to finish first. Just so you know, go get them. Tim, we have a question. I'm kidding. Don't get him. Tim is, I will at some point, I would love to be able to like break you Because you give me the best answer for every question, and like I want a passionately wrong answer at some point out of you. So that's going to be a challenge for me. This is a question from Andrew. And if you have questions for us, you can email askTedBerg@gmail.com. You can ask Tim at Tim Britton on Twitter. You can ask me at OG Tedberg on Twitter. Also, jump in my Instagram comments if you want. It's the same name. Andrew wants to know, what are the new rules and regulations regarding fan attendance at Citi Field for the start of the season? I know that the Mets front office is not firm with the ultimate changes that will be in place for opening day. Obviously, this is a state thing. He asked a question a while ago. What do you know, Tim?
First of all, I'm glad that you did not classify my disdain for the Tecobi Bellsbury nickname as passionately wrong. I appreciate that.
It's a good point. It's a good point.
So, you know, the Mets at this point, it's 20% capacity. That's 8,492. I like how specific they're being about that. They've only got single game tickets available at the moment. And in order to get in to Citi Field, you will have to have proof of either full vaccination or a negative COVID test. Inside, you know, you'll have to wear your mask unless you're actively drinking. Please interpret actively properly.
I always actively drink. All of my drinking is very active.
Like, do not be the person who holds the bottle of water to wave in a person's face when they're mad you're not wearing your mask. Like, it is very easy to slide the mask down, take a sip, slide the mask back up.
Oh, no, I was thinking like a way more active and way more drinking. Like, I'm thinking like one of these like obstacle course runs where you're guzzling beer the whole time. Like, that's how I drink, and it is quite active. And hey, it's okay if I don't wear a mask for that.
So that's me adding that. The Mets encourage you to wear your mask outside of times when you're actively drinking. And they will permit outside food and water. I'm trying to find the exact phrasing here. Glass bottles, all metal cans and containers, with the exception of reusable Swell or Yeti type metal water bottles, provided they're empty.
That makes sense.
Hard-sided coolers are not permitted, but guests may bring in one soft plastic factory sealed water bottle of 20 ounces or less. You can also bring in one sealed soft-sided child's juice box. Water bottles and juice boxes may not be frozen.
Yeah, because then they're projectiles. You don't want to let that in. That's people don't understand that rule. This is something, a little bit of a sore spot from my vending days, is when you sell the soda, you have to take the cap off, and people get so mad about that. Enough so that like I would actually just pocket soda caps and give them to people, or I'd give people their soda caps, and then I'd put my soda cap in the little bin where we had to return them all. Like that was like my special treat I would give people who were nice to me as a vendor. But it's a safety thing, right? It's because if you have a full bottle of soda in the upper deck of a sports event and you throw it, that could really do some damage, right? So like you can't have the cap.
And if your Capri Sun is frozen, you can't get the straw in there. So
why even do that? Yeah, maybe this is just like my warped 19-year-old mind that was fantasizing about people making projectiles out of soda. I don't actually know that for they maybe they had a totally different reason for it. That was just what I assumed.
No, I think you are correct on that one.
But now maybe I just like gave it up. Like they're like, oh, you shouldn't have told people about weaponizing soda. In which case, my bad, Tim. We should end there. Next time we talk, the Mets will have played a real baseball game.
Yeah, rain depending, weather permitting. I believe it is supposed to be in the 30s on Thursday night in
Washington,
D.C. Wait,
we're not going to do a recap podcast of a rain out, are we?
I mean, you know, we are slaves to the schedule. We will do what the schedule says. We are planning to have something out on Friday morning. I do suppose if Thursday night is rain or weathered out, we might hold off.
I don't know. You know, we could talk about whether or not they'll find a window.
My favorite pregame question on those days is, you know, you get in the manager's office and no one's willing to say anything, and someone just goes, so you guys think you got a window?
Always looking for that window. Yeah. Tim, thank you so much. As always, if you enjoyed the show, please rate us or review us on iTunes or anywhere else where you might rate and review podcasts. I don't think there are any other places, but if you're listening to the show there, that is a helpful thing for us. And again, if you have questions for the show, email me at asktedberg@gmail.com. Add us on Twitter. Check out all of Tim's stuff on The Athletic. Check out the Mets playing a real baseball game on Thursday. Tim, enjoy it and take care.
Adios.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.